Good afternoon. This is Shelley Fishman sitting in for Bill Buckmaster. Bill and his spouse are up in Victoria, Canada, up near Vancouver, and enjoying the cooler weather, I think. Assuming it's cooler there than it is here. It's been kind of weird up in the Northwest. The topic for today's discussion is going to be, because the stock market is behaving itself and fairly neutral today, we'll let it manage itself for the day, and we'll talk about estate planning. And I'm here with two very distinguished attorneys. Don Luce is a managing partner in Luce, Brown, and Hopkirk. And Don is a friend of the Buckmaster Show, so if you're a regular listener to the Buckmaster Show, you're familiar with Don and Don's expertise in many areas of the law, including estate planning and the things that go along with the documents you need to do a good job of managing an estate. Don is the author of A Handbook for Non-Lawyers and also Estate Planning in Arizona. So two books that really do help lay people understand what's necessary in the normal course of just, you know, planning what you need to plan for. Greg Wisnom is an attorney at Bogarts & Gordon. He is a specialist in estate and trust law and president of the Arizona Fiduciaries Association. Craig has also served as the regularly appearing legal mind on KVOA's News at 4. And so both of these guys have faces made for radio and television, and both are very, very familiar with the subject at hand, which, of course, is estate planning. So welcome, guys. Thank you for
Thank you,
being
Shelley.
Here.
Thank you.
And this whole show was really kind of triggered by a show we did several weeks ago that talked about the responsibilities of the people who need to administer the trust or the will after somebody dies, and that would be successor trustee or the people who manage probate with a will, and the importance of making those choices correctly. And then when Bill and I were talking about that afterwards, we said, well, let's do a whole show on estate planning and see if we can answer some questions that people might have in these areas. So we're going to do that today. The first segment of the show, we're going to talk just in general about what is estate planning and why it's important and why it's often postponed or avoided. Nobody likes to talk about dying. Nobody likes to talk about what happens to their money after they're dead. But estate planning is more than just when you die. It is also the documents that you might need before you die. For instance, if you become disabled and can't make decisions on your own. So those are all of the things we'll talk about today. With Don and Craig, I would also mention that the Buckmaster Live Line is open, and the number here, of course, is 790-2040. If you have questions for these two experts, please don't hesitate to give us a call. And so let me start right off with wills and trusts and estate planning and why it's important and why it shouldn't be avoided or postponed, even though it often is. And I'm going to go in alphabetical order and start with Don.
Thank you. So clients who come in often say to me, you know, we've waited way too long to get this done. And I say to them, no, you haven't. You're still alive.
That's true.
But people have, I think, this sense of foreboding about estate planning. And that's why I hear that comment so often, that they put it off. But estate planning, as you pointed out, Shelley, is more than just doing a will or doing a trust. It also involves ancillary documents like powers of attorney and living wills and maybe beneficiary deeds and those types of instruments that will actually help you plan for your future and plan for your family's future. And so if you're concerned about wealth preservation, if you're concerned about family planning, if you're concerned about succession planning, then it's really an important exercise to sit down with someone knowledgeable in estate planning and talk to them about what your objectives are.
Sure. Craig, with these documents that are not wills or trusts, but are documents intended to help a family through crises while they're still alive, what are we talking about here and why are they important?
Well, we're talking about generally two different types of powers of attorney. One of those might be called a durable general or a financial power of attorney or a property power of attorney. And the core purpose of that document is that if you become incapacitated and you can no longer pay your bills, access your investments, deal with your assets, you name the person or the people who are going to make those decisions for you. Now, if you have a trust, the trust actually kind of dovetails with that as well, because that also kind of comes into being with a successor trustee in the event you're incapacitated. But it's basically to make sure your business of you can keep running. And if you don't have those documents, the only other outlet is the court to appoint a guardian or a conservator.
What triggers the things that you put in a power of attorney? What gets them started? Are they automatic? Does a judge have to say, okay, this person is incapacitated and can't make decisions on their own? How does that work?
Well, the answer is, as with all legal issues, it depends.
Yeah.
Some powers of attorney for finances are drafted so that you don't need any particular action to happen for them to be effective. And essentially, you're maybe leaving them with the attorney, but trusting whoever you named is not going to take advantage of you while you're competent, because otherwise they're probably not a good choice to be naming if you're incompetent.
Okay.
Some powers of attorney based on client preference or even attorney preference have a triggering clause that's usually a doctor writing a letter saying Mr. Smith can no longer handle his finances because he's suffering from dementia or something similar.
And does a judge have to say yea verily, or does it automatically kick in?
Almost all the time, the judge in the court is not involved with those type of documents. That's where you end up in court with a judge if you don't do powers of attorney, where someone has to go in and petition the court for a guardian and conservator, and that is an expensive and an intrusive process.
Right. And Don, what's a health care power of attorney, and why is that different?
Well, a health care power of attorney doesn't govern relationships with banks or brokerages or have anything to do with money. It has to do exclusively with empowering someone to make healthcare decisions for you in the event that you're incapacitated and cannot make your own healthcare decisions.
Yes. And do those documents need to be on file anywhere so that, for instance, a doctor or a hospital will honor them?
Well, it's pretty customary when you go to a hospital or even to your doctor's office for your annual checkup for them to ask, do you have a living will? Do you have a power of attorney? And if so, can we have a copy?
So put them in a briefcase and bring them with you to the hospital.
What I like to tell my clients is there's usually a place in your home where you keep important papers. You keep copies of your life insurance policies or your car titles or whatever. Keep your healthcare directives and your trust and your will in that place so that, if necessary, your family and friends will know where to find those documents, and they can then be used in the event that they become necessary.
So if I'm, you know, John Q. Public, and I go to the web and I go and I pull up a form of a will and I fill in all the stuff and I say I'm done, right?
Well, you're going to make me a little bit more money on the back end, and I'm not sure you want to do that. So
wait a second. So the documents kind of come as a package. So we should have a will or a trust. We should have the necessary living documents, mm-hmm. powers of attorney. Anything else that would be in that package?
There may be. I tell people the basic fundamentals everybody should have are the will, the financial power of attorney, and that health care, medical power of attorney, and living will. Some people may opt for a trust, which has some additional benefits.
And we'll
that
talk
may
about that.
Exactly.
Sure.
But those are the three fundamentals. Now, people may also do beneficiary deeds. One thing that's critical, that's more your province than what we lawyers do, is the beneficiaries on accounts and retirement
In other
plans.
Words, titling things in such a way mm-hmm. that perhaps trusts or wills may not necessarily be necessary. That's a great bridge. We'll talk more about that because, you know, everybody doesn't need a will or a trust. They may need powers of attorney, but they don't necessarily need wills or trusts. So we're going to take a break right now, but I'm going to remind everybody that this portion of the Buckmaster Show is presented by Silver City in Grant County, New Mexico, just 3 hours east of Tucson. So much to do in Silver City and Grant County, New Mexico, like exploring historic downtown Silver City or visiting the world-famous Cliff Dwellings National Monument. For a complete listing of the many things to do and the great places to stay, visit southwestnewmexico.org. We'll take a break and be right back.
The Arizona Wildcats kick off the 2017 football season this Saturday, September 2nd, with Fan Appreciation Night and an exclusive bobblehead giveaway of NFL superstar Rob Gronkowski. Go to ArizonaWildcats.com/FB to buy your tickets and learn more about bringing home your own Gronk bobblehead, or call 621-CATS. Single game tickets start at just $12. Come out and support our Wildcats and bear down.
The Twisted Tandoor, the legendary Indian food truck, now has a permanent brick-and-mortar home at Swan and Camp Lowell Drive. The menu expands on the popular Indian classic offerings from the original Twisted Tandoor food truck. The Twisted Tandoor, it's at 4660 East Camp Lowell Drive and on the web at thetwistedtandoor.com. This is Bill Buckmaster. One of my passions is travel, visiting over 100 countries in all 50 states. When I'm ready to take off, I fly from Tucson International Airport. With 6 airlines flying nonstop to 19 destinations and easy one-stop connections, I can get virtually anywhere in the world. It's close by, convenient, with competitive airfares, and the best part is there's no long drive coming back home after a long trip. Check out flytucson.com, travel smart, and fly Tucson. It's the way to go. The Regional Transportation Authority funds projects helping make our transportation system safe, reliable, and efficient, and improved mobility leads to a better economy and new jobs through the increased flow of people, goods, and services. More efficient access gets us to where we want to go faster, and that means more time for family. Working together for a better future, more at rtamobility.com. As a small business owner, I know the importance of a certified public accountant you can trust. That's why I recommend my CPA, Michael C. Flowers of Flowers, Rieger & Associates, proud sponsors of the Buckmaster Show. Located at 2919 East Broadway and on the web at flowersrieger.com, or follow the live link on buckmastershow.com.
The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun cover two of Arizona's most desirable communities. The newspapers reach more than 75% of the communities each week, with a combined population of more than 50,000. The Green Valley News also publishes a dozen magazines each year, and both newspapers publish up-to-the-minute local news online at gvnews.com. The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun, it's all right here.
The average person in the USA today takes over 12 prescription medicines each year, and if you're over age 65, it is more than 17 medicines. CredibleMeds.org is a nonprofit organization dedicated to helping inform you and your healthcare providers. Over 30,000 people die each year from reactions to their medicines. Don't be one of those numbers. Be informed and stay safe. Visit CredibleMeds.org today and take control of your healthcare by taking your medicines safely.
This is Bill Buckmaster, the Buckmaster Show, featuring Arizona newsmakers and more than 24 Buckmaster Show contributors. Everything from foreign affairs to the arts is on the table and open for discussion and your calls from one end of Southern Arizona to the other. Always on BuckmasterShow.com for all of our podcasts. Buckmaster, noon to 1 on AM 1030 KVOI.
Yeah. And we're back live in the studio. Shelley Fishman sitting in for Bill Buckmaster, talking about wills and trusts today with two of Tucson's most prominent estate attorneys. We have Don Luce and we have Craig Wisdom. And we're getting into the whole idea of what's the difference between a will and a trust and why it makes a difference. And we could go on for about 7 hours on this, but we won't. So, Don, you've got 25 seconds to make us all explode.
Starting now. Well, you know, that's a question that everyone wants the answer to. Why do I need a trust, or why isn't a will, quote, good enough? The difference between a will and a trust is basically a will needs to be probated in order for it to become effective. A trust is administered outside of the judicial system. A judge does not generally supervise the administration of a trust. And so those things which are done in court with a will can be done privately and within the family with a trust.
So the only time you would get somebody challenging a trust would be if somebody has an interest in that trust and a reason to challenge it.
Generally speaking, that's true. Now, the Uniform Trust Act, which has been adopted in Arizona as the Arizona Trust Code with some modification, allows any interested person, so it could be a beneficiary, it could be a successor trustee, it could be somebody who thinks they have an interest in a trust, gives them standing to go to court to ask the judge to either provide instructions or to enter orders to facilitate the administration of the trust. So the court is always there, but I have to tell you, in my 35 years of experience, it is relatively rare for a lawsuit to be filed involving trust administration. The vast majority of trust administration matters are handled privately and without any court supervision whatsoever.
And they're private. So that's one probate, of the, where probate is a matter of public record, trusts are private. So, Craig, talking about a trust or talking about a will brings up two terms that I've tried to avoid a little bit in the first segment, and we should get into a little bit now. And that is, what is a trustee? Mm-hmm. What is a successor trustee? And what is an executor?
Well, generally, it's a very similar job. The trustee is the person who acts under the trust. So if you go the route of a revocable trust, most people start as their own trustee, so they maintain complete control. But they name that successor trustee who, once they become incapacitated or upon their death, that person or that entity steps in and handles the business of the trust, which is generally collect assets, pay bills, manage things, sell things, and then ultimately divide them up among the beneficiaries. The personal representative in Arizona, which is also referred to as the executor, is really the person that does that same job, but when there is a will and they have to get appointed by the court, as Don said, to carry out that role.
So that's called probate.
Mm-hmm.
And if I'm the executor of somebody's will, do I do that on my own or do I go and hire a lawyer?
Most people go through a lawyer like us. It's not required. You know, the people can try to figure out the forms themselves at the court and the self-help desks and such. And so there are certainly people that do that. We call them pro pers, people who represent themselves. But a lot of people like the attorney to be able to handle them and guide them through that process.
And if I have a life, in other words, a job and a family, and there's a pretty steep learning curve there, I imagine.
Absolutely. As I tell people, when they are selecting the people in their documents at the planning stage, think of it one way. It is a job. You are picking the person or maybe the bank or the licensed fiduciary who's going to be doing this job. It's not about who you love. It's not about who you like more. It's not about who you respect. It's who you think will be in the best position to do that job we talked about.
Uh-huh. And Don, what's the difference between a trustee and a successor trustee?
Well, as Craig alluded to, the trustee is appointed by the person creating the trust, and generally that same person is also named as the initial trustee. So, for instance, Shelley, if you created a trust, chances are that you would be both the trustor, being the person who created the trust, and also the trustee, being the person who is responsible for administration of the trust during your lifetime. A successor trustee is someone who is nominated by the trustor to take over the duties of trustee when the initial trustee can no longer perform those duties. So, for instance, should the trustor become incapacitated, then the successor trustee may take over the duties, or, of course, should the trustor pass away, then the successor trustee would become the sole trustee.
So do executors and trustees get paid for what they do?
Absolutely. And I say that as someone who's a licensed fiduciary, so when we're a professional, we get paid. But it's not just professionals. It is a great outpouring of time, effort, learning, and quite frankly, stress, and sometimes it can be very emotionally unpleasant. Sometimes clients drafting the documents, people think that people won't want to charge under these documents. But I feel very strongly that whoever it is, individual or family member, otherwise, they have a right to do that. Ultimately, whoever serves has to make that decision for themselves. But in fact, the trust code that Don alluded to, even if you put in a trust that the person is not entitled to compensation or that they're entitled to an excessive amount of compensation, the courts can overrule that because they figure every trustee or personal representative is entitled to reasonable compensation, no more, no less. But that's a gray area.
So what I'm hearing here is that if you have a will, you're going to save a little bit of money up front. And if you have a trust, you're going to spend a little bit of money up front. And then the flip sides of that kind of apply.
Mm-hmm. That's not a bad way to look at it. Most people who only have a will have expended less money on the front side for the preparation of those documents than people who have both a will and a trust, because of course the trust is a separate document that requires separate considerations and results in additional legal fees on the front end.
Okay. We have a question from Greg. Greg, thanks for calling the Buckmaster Show. I kind of get a heads up from Ray what your question is. It's a little complex, but please thank you for the call, and please state your question.
You bet, Shelley. First, I'd like to say the folks down at the probate division here of the Superior Court, they've been wonderful over the years when I was appointed guardian and conservator for my my sister and my dad. But let me get to the question for your guests. 8 years ago, my mom decided to obtain a reverse mortgage on the house that I'm presently in. And the bank, I won't identify the bank, they signed her up and everything seemed good to go. Now, the only thing is, my mom had put the house in a trust, and my reading of the law, and maybe your guests can help me with this, essentially, my brother and I were under 60 at the time, but I think the Heckam guidelines dictate that we both had to be of age as well, meaning over 65, and we weren't. And lastly, my mom, who passed away, may she rest in peace, she left the house to me in her will. So now I have this problem. It's kind of a quagmire, and I might have to come into either office of your guest. But if the bank made a mistake, or let's say the escrow company made a mistake and didn't stop that lender from coming in, shouldn't the house be mine?
So, Greg, here's how I'm going to deal with your question. You are absolutely right. You need to make an appointment with one of these guys.
Okay.
This is very complex. We could spend hours on reverse mortgages. We could spend hours on what happens when a reverse mortgage is sold or administered improperly. But I'm going to use this as a really good example of why you need a professional to help you do these documents and make these decisions, because there's a gazillion ways you can mess it up. And when you do, the successors, the executor, the successor trustees, or your relatives and beneficiaries then need to deal with, how do you deal with this? How awful is this for us now? And by the way, you know, you're dead. You don't care. But you've left this big mess for somebody else to deal with. One of the really great reasons I think this show and other shows like it are so important. We're going to take a break. We're going to come back and talk about some other things regarding these kinds of subjects under estate planning.
Tucson now has its own Creole restaurant, named after the classic New Orleans cocktail. Sazerac Creole Kitchen and Cocktail Parlor is located in St. Phillips Plaza at River and Campbell. The New Orleans-inspired menu includes a full range of gumbos and much-loved beignets. See you soon at Sazerac, open daily, 8 a.m. to midnight at St. Phillips Plaza.
Did you know that you can check out complete digital editions of popular magazines with your Pima County Public Library card? From Arizona Highways to Yoga Journal and everything in between, the library is your source for entertainment. Visit library.pima.gov and browse the e-library to start checking out your favorite magazines today. That's library.pima.gov.
If you're searching for that special one-of-a-kind item, may I suggest Adobe House Antiques. It has a vast collection and variety of antiques, lighting, and fine art. In addition to the interior space, a large outdoor location offers an extensive collection of vintage patio furniture, exterior lighting, and ironwork. Come see Penny at 2700 North Campbell, 325-9439, or on the web at adobehouseantiques.com.
The Southern Arizona News Examiner, reporting the stories missed by the mainstream media. Our sources bring you regional, national, and international news from a different perspective. Opinion from top national columnists, plus Eric Peters with auto reviews, Bob Garver on movies, a section on Western heritage, and sports coverage, too. It's a cross-section of information found nowhere else. SOAZNewsX.com. Subscriptions are free at SOAZNewsX.com.
This is Bill Buckmaster. Green Things has been the place for all things green for the Buckmaster household for many years. From 2-inch succulents to 10-foot tall palms and desert trees, Green Things has it all on 13 acres and 33 greenhouses full of plants, pottery, and gardening supplies. Visit Green Things at 3384 East River Road by the Rito Riverwalk and on the web at greenthingsaz.com.
What comes to mind when you envision the holidays? If it means surrounding yourself with family and friends as you welcome treasured traditions, just imagine if those moments were paired with sinking your toes in fine white sand and exploring quaint seaside towns. This winter, spend your holiday with a sense of adventure on a family reunion vacation. At Bon Voyage, we specialize in bringing generations together through travel. This is the perfect time to plan. Call Bon Voyage Travel at 797-1110.
Noble Hops is Tucson's original gastro pub, serving an impressive menu of craft beer and fine fare. Choose from more than 175 beers from around the world, plus wine and a full bar. Enjoy delicious soups, salads, burgers, sandwiches, hearty entrees, and more. Craft beer, fine fare, great service, and stunning views. Noble Hops, perfect for lunch, dinner, happy hour, late night, and any time in between. Open daily at La Cañada and Lambert Lane in Oro Valley.
And we're back. This is Shelley Fishman sitting in for Bill Buckmaster. And we're here talking about estate plans and wills and trusts. And we're here with Craig Wisnam and Don Luce. And we got into a really difficult question just before the break. And so I want to open that up a little bit more because it really exemplifies why these decisions are so very, very important. And Don, when you're choosing a successor trustee or choosing an executor, what are your choices? I mean, who do you normally look at to do this job? And why may those not necessarily be the right choices?
Boy, that's a great question. And that's a question that every person who's thinking about creating a trust or making a will has to answer. And it has to be an honest answer, both for themselves and for the beneficiary. So the obvious choices are family members. So if you have adult children who have the ability to administer and manage your financial affairs, they can make great choices for both personal representative and successor trustees. But your universe isn't limited to just family members. There are a lot of people who don't have a lot of family members to call upon to serve in that role, or the family members that that are available and do have the ability to perform, maybe at an age where down the road it wouldn't be suitable to name them because, you know, they wouldn't live typically long enough to perform all of their duties.
Great point.
So the universe then is expanded to include public fiduciaries, banks with trust departments. And in some cases, not always, but some people have very trustworthy friends and friends that who are close enough that would be willing to serve in that role. Now, that having been said, and I think Craig alluded to this earlier, being a successor trustee is not a glamorous job. And, you know, whether a family member chooses to accept compensation to perform those duties or not, the fact remains that it's a lot of work. It's pretty much tedious work because you're collecting assets. You're getting the house ready to sell. You're dealing with real estate agents and brokers.
And you live in Boston.
Hopefully not. But sometimes that's the only person available, the person who does live in Boston. So it's not a job that doesn't come without a lot of responsibility. People who agree to serve as successor trustees and who are family members typically do it out of a sense of loyalty to the person who's named them.
And doesn't the scope of that job kind of change over time so that in proximate time to the time of death, there are some things that just need to be done right away, mm-hmm. getting the house in order, taking care of the cat and dog,
right.
You know, making sure bills are paid, making sure the final, maybe the final tax statements are taken care of. But over time, that job then stretches out and might be more or as appropriately done from afar. But can you imagine trying to administer those things from across the country?
And here's one of the things that I think is helpful about people going through an attorney to do their documents. That family has, even if they're the person named under that document, they've got someone they can call to start with to help them figure out what to do next.
Right. You used the term, and Don, you used it as well, and I've used it on this show a bunch when we talk about what the responsibilities of professionals may be. And you talked about a fiduciary.
Yes.
Now, that term means different things to different people, but could you kind of peel back that onion a little
bit? I'm using it as a term of art that's really best described as a licensed fiduciary in Arizona. And essentially, Arizona put together through the Supreme Court a process where people who wanted to professionally serve as trustee, personal representative, guardian, power of attorney would have to go through certain training and background checks to get licensed to do that job. So that in Arizona is one of the professional options people have to turn to if they have family members who cannot act or they don't have family members or even if it's a second or third choice after the family members.
So they would hire a licensed fiduciary rather than an attorney to do this job. And what does the term imply?
Well, the general term of fiduciary is you're acting in the best interest of someone else.
Right.
In this term, we're saying people, all these jobs we've mentioned, trustee, personal representative, agent under a power of attorney, they are all fiduciary roles. So that's the umbrella that covers it. Some attorneys are licensed fiduciaries like myself and the attorneys at our firm. There are other non-attorneys who are licensed and such. And then still part of the universe are the bank and the trust companies that have more traditionally served in these roles. And they typically may have minimums above what private fiduciaries have in terms of an estate has to be a certain size. And they also generally cannot act under powers of attorney in certain documents.
Okay. And I always think of the term, when we're talking about estate documents, as strict adherence to the documents. In other words, very little arbitrary, that's not the right word, very little judgmental responsibility, more what does the document say?
Well, that's an interesting point, Shelley, because most people creating a trust want some assurance that the trustee who follows them is going to abide by their wishes. I always suggest to the person creating the trust, however, that they think about the discretion that might be necessary in order for a fiduciary to properly perform the duties of a successor trustee. There are a lot of things that arise in life, as we all know, that are unanticipated. And as much as someone may want to put in place controls regarding the functions and duties of a successor trustee, there is a lot to be said for allowing the successor trustee, especially if it's a fiduciary or a trust company, latitude in terms of discretion for paying out principal or interest or income from the trust. A lot of people believe that it is best that their beneficiaries attain a certain age, for instance, before they receive their distribution. And in those cases, the successor trustee is going to be administering that trust for a period of time following the death of the trustor until the beneficiary attains the specified age. And a lot of things can happen in that period of time that the trustor never thought about.
So when you're talking to your clients or friends about these kinds of things, just as a general guideline, if I draw up a will or if I draw up a trust, how long is it good for?
Well, while it may depend, wills are pretty much permanent in terms of their applicability. The probate court doesn't really care whether, if you file an appropriate will, whether it was drafted 40 years ago or last week. Powers of attorney, according to financial institutions, it's not a legal issue, but their policies and procedures are very distrustful of old powers of attorney. Mm-hmm. And some of them have official policies that say if this is more than 5 years old,
they won't recognize
we won't accept it.
Absolutely.
I've heard some people throw out 6 months, which is completely unreasonable. But we tell people if they really want to try to be getting a gold star on their preparation, updating those powers of attorney every 5 years would be appropriate.
So you've given me a legal answer.
Mm-hmm.
How about the practical answer? Oh, I did my trust 10 years ago. I'm okay.
Well, you may be. You know, the question is to make sure it says what you want it to say and perhaps review it to an attorney. And there are times people will come in and will say, this is fine. There's no need to change it. Sometimes you
you should pull it out of the safe deposit box and review it periodically.
I tell people if they, again, want to be get a gold star, try to take a look at it yourself once a year.
Sure.
Just remind yourself, wait, I have Joe named as my personal representative who's now in jail for money laundering. Maybe I should update that.
Okay. Before we break, because I dropped the idea that you keep it in a safe deposit box. Where do you keep these documents and how many copies should there be and who should have them?
That's a great question. And what I always tell our clients is a safe deposit box is okay, but a better place to keep your documents would be at home in a secure place where you keep your other important papers. Mm-hmm. And the reason is twofold. Number one, if you've ever tried to get into somebody else's safe deposit box, you know the challenges. And number two, it's not intuitive that you would know where a person's safe deposit box is located, whereas you would probably know that in the desk drawer where they keep all of their other important papers, they're probably going to be keeping their trust or their will or their powers of attorney. It's easier to access. It's quicker to access, and you don't have to depend on third parties to permit access to the documents.
Okay.
The bottom line is it should be someplace that is secure but accessible by the people who may need it. Some attorneys like to keep originals. Others do not. We happen to fall on the side. We keep a lot of originals for clients.
And what about the people you've named in those documents? Should they have copies?
What I tell our clients is give copies of the documents to people that you feel comfortable sharing the information with. You don't necessarily need to provide the document to tell the person that you've nominated them, and if an event arises, then they should access the document for further information.
Okay. That's
The medical powers of attorney are the critical ones that I think the agent should have, because usually no one needs a financial power of attorney in the middle of the night. They may need that medical power of attorney in the middle of the night, and it's also more personal, so it's nice if mom says, look, here it is, here's what I want. People may be a little bit more comfortable than if they've never seen that before.
Okay. We're going to take another break, the last break of the show, and then we're going to come back and talk about exceptions to all of these things and things that you also need to keep in mind. But I need to remind our audience that this portion of the Buckmaster Show is presented by Green Things, located at 3384 East River Road, just west of the intersection of Dodge and River, just west of Brady Fenton Park. Check out Green Things on 13 acres for all your gardening and green things. For more, visit greenthingsarizona.com. And we'll be back with our two experts right after this break.
American Openings is pleased to sponsor Hands of Hope. Hands of Hope believes every life matters, and they're committed to walking alongside women to provide confidential, non-judgmental care so they can make the best decisions when unsure about continuing with a pregnancy. You can learn more about Hands of Hope at GiveHopeTucson.com. American Openings is a locally owned door and window manufacturer and is blessed to be a sponsor of a local ministry doing so much to protect life.
Vero Amore is Tucson's only certified authentic Neapolitan wood-fired pizza, where every flavorful pizza, pasta, panini, and salad is homemade using the finest local and imported ingredients. Vero Amore, Plaza Palomino and on Dove Mountain Boulevard in Marana, plus a full catering menu and mobile pizza truck for parties and events. Vero Amore on the web at veroamore.com.
Did you know that you can check out complete digital editions of popular magazines with your Pima County Public Library card? From Arizona Highways to Yoga Journal and everything in between, the library is your source for entertainment. Visit library.pima.gov and browse the e-library to start checking out your favorite magazines today. That's library.pima.gov.
This is Bill Buckmaster. I love travel and flying from Tucson International Airport. And when you fly Tucson, you're standing up for Tucson. When more people fly Tucson, airlines respond with more flights. And with more flights, more travelers can get here to conduct important business. It's a win for the region, and it's a win for you in time saved and money saved not traveling to an airport 2 hours away. Next time you book a flight, type in TUS. Travel smart and fly Tucson. It's the way to go. The Regional Transportation Authority is on track to deliver the remainder of the promised projects in the 20-year plan, now in its 11th year. A recent 10-year performance audit finds the RTA sticking to the plan and schedule. The RTA applauds our members and partners for helping us to stay on schedule and to improve our transportation network for everyone. Working together for a better future, more at rtamobility.com. Cushman & Wakefield PICOR is Tucson's leading independently owned full-service commercial real estate company. Founded in 1985, Cushman & Wakefield PICOR offers leasing, sales, and property management for industrial, office, medical, retail, land, and investment properties in Tucson and Sonora, Mexico. Visit our website at PICOR.com for the latest news from Tucson's commercial real estate sector. That's PICOR.com. Call us at 748-7100.
Hi, it's Suzanne Miller from your Better Business Bureau serving Southern Arizona, here to remind you to start with trust and look for the BBB accredited seal when searching for a product or service. Did you know you can request a quote directly from any of our accredited businesses? With over 3,000 accredited businesses in Southern Arizona, you will find a business you can trust. Whether you need a product or service from one company or an entire industry, go to tucson.bbb.org and start your search today.
Are you happy with the news you get? While not all news is good news, you know good reporting when you see it. Check TucsonSentinel.com every day for breaking news and investigative reports. Have your say in the comments. It's all in TucsonSentinel.com, your local, independent, nonprofit news. You can rely on TucsonSentinel.com for solid reporting about immigration, Tucson and Pima politics, everything from the border to baseball. It's independent news without the spin. TucsonSentinel.com. We are watching Tucson.
And we're back live. Shelley Fishman sitting in for Bill Buckmaster, talking about estates, estate planning, and why it's important, here with Don Luce and Craig Wisdom, both estate attorneys, having a great discussion. And I'm going to still leave the Buckmaster line open at 790-2040 if you've got a quick question or comment. And let's talk about exceptions. Let's talk about some of the things you might not think about and why it's important. For instance, what if I say, I don't need a will. I've got everything taken care of in the documents that represent the ownership of my stuff. And I've listed my beneficiaries, and I've got, for instance, joint tenancy and ownership in that. Is that okay?
Yeah, that's perfectly okay. And in fact, some of our clients come in and they make that declaration. I don't think I need a will, but you tell me. And I look to see what they own, and it's a house with a beneficiary deed properly recorded and a bank account that has beneficiaries designated on death. And I tend to agree with them. It's not a bad idea to have a will as an umbrella or a safety net, but not everyone needs a will in order to dispose of their asset. It really depends on what a person owns and how they own it.
Well, but let me give you an example. And this also ties in, just so you know, when you do a trust, most attorneys, and I think you should, have a will that goes along with it called a pour-over will.
Right.
And the idea is somewhat the same. People might say, well, if I've put everything I know in the trust, why do I even need that? And the answer, just like even if you don't have a trust, having some will, is you just never know. You probably won't need that will, that pour-over will, if you get everything titled right, or if you don't have a trust, if you have all the assets designated right, but you never know. Let me give you an example. We had a case where we were involved in the settlement of a personal injury lawsuit for a gentleman. There was a significant settlement, and he died before it was collected. So his estate was in place to receive a fairly significant settlement. He was married to someone and had a child from a prior relationship, a child to whom he had not spoken with in 30 years. Because he had no will, not even the most simple will saying, I leave everything to my wife, he was stuck with the intestate statute, which divided that asset between his spouse and his long abandoned child, whom he hadn't had any contact with. And so that's the kind of example. True, it doesn't happen for a lot of people.
Right.
It's not that prevalent, but you just can't say with any certainty.
But something I do see very often is somebody who thinks they've titled their assets correctly because they have it in joint ownership with rights of survivorship, and the two of them die together.
Mm-hmm.
And it hasn't listed the beneficiaries in the titling of the asset.
That's right. And to Craig's point, having a will does provide that kind of a safety net. Now, to add to what Craig said, if you have a validly executed will, Arizona law allows you to leave a list of tangible personal property so that if you want to leave, for instance, a family item or a piece of jewelry to a particular person, you can write that down on a piece of paper.
So let me get this straight. The titling of the house doesn't include the contents.
Not necessarily.
Mm-mm. No.
You need a separate document for that.
And here's the beauty of that, too. If you have a family that wants to fight, and yet the documents were done well, the assets are fairly simple, and there is essentially nothing to fight about, here's where they find something to fight about. You should have given me the china. Where did that silverware go? I know Dad had some silver dollars somewhere in that. I think you've taken them. So to plan some sort of general provisions for that tangible personal property so that someone can't sue your executor over phantom tangible items can be a good idea.
Okay. Let's take a look at some other possible exceptions or possible needs that you know, more and more these days are not so rare in families. Let's say you have a beneficiary who might be impaired, or a beneficiary who, for one reason or another, might have an alcohol or a drug problem. What documents and where in those documents do you note that and make, you know, take account of that?
So generally, in a trust agreement, the trustor will address those types of issues. If there's a family member who is addicted to drugs, that's an issue, because you wouldn't necessarily want that family member to receive his or her distribution upon your death in a lump sum, thinking that perhaps that distribution would then facilitate the addiction.
Sure.
So,
yeah, and when you have someone who's under an impairment, a special needs trust that can be done under your revocable trust or as a separate document is a simple way to benefit them, but to not only provide for the management of someone who can't handle those finances themselves, but to preserve any government benefits they have.
So a trust can be used to set up other trusts.
Exactly. And I would say it is probably the most important and powerful use of a trust, because avoiding probate may be well and good, but that's nothing compared to protecting a beneficiary over his or her lifetime.
Right. And another thing that comes up very often as a question is, well, if I leave an asset or a portion of my assets to someone who is married and then that person dies, not the spouse, but the person I've left it to dies, who gets the asset at my death?
Yeah, that is a question that is directly addressed with our clients at the time that they make the trust or the will. Do they want that asset or that share to go to the decedent's children, or do they want that share to go to the other beneficiaries in some percentage? Most people, if it's a child, tell me that they would want that child's share to go to their children, to be divided among the children of the deceased child equally.
And that's called?
It's called prestirpes.
Prestirpes, not stripes.
Yeah, if you look at it quickly, it might look like per stripes or per, you don't think it's Latin, per stirps. But yes, it's a term defined under Arizona law. We're not trying to prove how smart we are throwing a little Latin in the document, but the law defines the whole pattern no matter how complicated it gets.
So if you want the money to go to the child's spouse, that's not per stirpes.
No.
That's got to be specified somewhere.
You have to be very specific writing that in. And occasionally clients will want that, but it's somewhat of a rarity, and it's where sometimes that child has no children or there's a huge affection and it's a long-term marriage.
Or
some people
you
like
want the
spouse.
Surviving parent to be the trustee for their child's trust, their minor child's trust, until that minor child is old enough to inherit the money and use it wisely.
And that's one more use of a trust for children, even if they survive, structuring their share in a continuing trust rather than outright, even for ones who are old enough, who don't have drug addiction, who don't have special needs. That continued trust is held more protected from their spouse in case they ever get divorced or in case they ever get sued or have other creditors. So again, these lifetime or continuing trusts can be one of the most powerful benefits you get under a revocable trust arrangement.
And to Craig's point, circling back to what we were discussing earlier, that's why it's so important to properly select a successor trustee, because oftentimes these trusts which are created on the death of the trustor last decades. And so if you haven't selected a trustee who can do the job, then you're inviting litigation after your death to figure out what the problem is and to put somebody in there who can actually do the job properly.
Yeah. A trustee will make all the judgment calls for the beneficiary. So in a fairly typical trust, if a grandchild's 18 years old and they go to the trustee and say, I need to go to college, the trustee can write them a check for tuition.
So this sounds all a little bit overwhelming. If I'm not an attorney, if I just want to you know, take care of my family in the correct way, but I say I really do need to sit down with somebody. What's the process? Do they give you a call? What can they expect? I'm not talking about somebody with $10 million.
No, at our office, when they call, our receptionist will schedule an appointment, but beforehand we'll send them a questionnaire to fill out, which contains some basic information about their family and their property. And so then when they come in, we are prepared to discuss with them their situation and to make some recommendations.
Ours is a very similar process. I would just tie in as bookend to what I think Don started with. There are so many times clients meet with us, and by the time they're done, they say, that was a lot easier than I thought it was.
Right.
I shouldn't have been so scared of it. You know, so keep that in mind. They don't have to be intimidated.
Okay. Guys, we're running out of time. These things always take, you know, longer than they appear to at first. Thank you, Craig Wisnom and Don Luce. It's been a great show. I would include, if you have a financial planner, get the financial planner involved too, because he can really guide you. He or she can really guide you to not only make some of these decisions, but when it's really important to hire an attorney.
Thank you, Shelley.
Thank you very much, everyone.
Ray Allen, thanks for doing a great job.